We're going from bench to bedside now. And I want to thank Dr. Ballard for putting his slides up on the web from his wonderful webcast about the problems with syphilis diagnosis, because I stole a lot of your slides. And I'm giving you credit right now. Okay, these are evolving challenges actually for clinicians using the laboratory diagnoses that are out there. So I would like to put it back at you and say this is what you need to fix for us. Okay? MSM and syphilis, why is it important now? What's recommended? What are the problems that we have at the bedside with the diagnosis? Well, primary and secondary syphilis, the male to female ratio is increasing. We have, no matter where you look at it, increases in cities throughout the United States. This is U.S. cities with increases of more than 50 reported primary and syphilis cases by number. Look for your city. And the MSM Prevalence Monitoring Project shows that men who have sex with men are increasing in their seroreactivity for serologic tests for syphilis, and also with the titer being greater than 1 to 16, indicative in people's minds of newly acquired syphilis. Now, here's the problem. The problem is that a lot of these cases are being diagnosed outside of the STD clinics, where we need good tests, and people don't know how to use the tests that are already out there. So what's recommended? We have primary and secondary syphilis. What we now do is we go after lesions. We do dark field, direct immunofluorescence, if we can get our hands on it, and hopefully, please God, PCR. With our primary and secondary syphilis, early latent, late latent syphilis of unknown duration, late syphilis, we're stuck with serology. Okay, and I mean stuck. This is the dark field. Few clinicians have dark field microscopes, and even if you do, few clinicians know how to use them. We have the DFA, and few labs actually offer this, and it takes time to perform, so it's not a quick point-of-care test. So we're stuck with serologic tests for syphilis, which are treponemal, as you all know, and non-treponemal, and we need both to make an accurate diagnosis of syphilis. So this is a little review of what's already out there. Most of us use either the VDRL or the rapid plasma reagent test, and then we confirm it with the treponemal test, usually the FTA absorption test, or the now the TPPA, and these are little cartoons of how it works if you're interested. Now, we as clinicians have to select and interpret lesions and serologic tests appropriately. Lesion-based tests are used only for primary syphilis and in some cases secondary syphilis, condyloma nodosa, for example. The sensitivity and specificity of the serology actually varies by those multi-stages of syphilis. We have to look at the presence of antibody, and you know, it doesn't always distinguish a new case from an old case. And then we have to grapple with quantitative tests, because we use those to evaluate, did you respond to my bicillin shot or not? None of this is perfect. Biologic false positives come up. You're all familiar with these. We as clinicians have to deal with this. And you know, biologic false positives with pregnancy, for example, is a very big hassle. So for the most part, if you're positive, you're positive until proven otherwise. And then the classic sensitivity of serologic tests. Well, incubation period here, where you really want to get them from a public health standpoint, tests are negative. I mean, you're incubating, you have new syphilis, we want you then. Tests are negative. Finally, they become positive and they stay up there. This is in weeks from exposure, and this is all good. All the tests are great, the normal tests we use. And then years later, stuff starts to decline, the RPR declines. So all of these are challenges for me, the clinician, to try to interpret who has what, how do I report it, do I need to get partners in immediately, what's the situation? Okay. Sensitivity of serologic tests in untreated syphilis. This is a classic slide that we use to train clinicians on how to use these tests. Be aware. Your primary syphilis, your lab test, which you in the ED, in the emergency room, you often rely on these tests. They're not perfect. All right. So the traditional approach is all patients have a screening RPR. And I'm talking, and now realize, I know this is MSM, but quite frankly, it doesn't matter, MSM or anything else. This is the way we approach this. If the RPR is positive, FTA ABS is automatically performed. And in, as we said, in certain clinical situations, you might want to order an FTA despite regardless of the RPR because it comes up positive before. We don't usually do this, but we say think about it. Okay, you all know this, the qualitative RPR test. Okay, now, what's positive, what isn't? My eyes may be different from your eyes. What's positive, what isn't? Is this positive, is this negative? Okay, this is positive, that's negative. We can argue, okay? That's the problem. All right. Treponema serology, the principle is to measure antibodies directed against T. pallidum antigens. Qualitative, it should be positive or negative. And as a clinician, please don't give me an intermediate on this. Work it out in the lab. Don't tell me it's 1+. Tell me positive or negative because I'm going to go nuts. I'm telling you, I'm going to go nuts if you tell me something different. Usually it's reactive for life, but as you saw, there's some that disappear. Okay, so the treponema tests that we usually do are listed here. Now, fluorescent treponema antibody tests, one test, time-consuming treponema pallidum hemagglutination test listed here. Here's the treponema pallidum passive particulate agglutination assay. You know, the interpretations are down here. Thank you, Dr. Ballard, for this slide. All right. Interpretation for me is listed here. RPR reactive, FTA non-reactive, false positive. Or is it a false negative FTA? Okay. Reactive. Okay, I got a case. It's a new case, or it's an old case that is inadequately treated, or it's an old case that's inadequately treated or adequately treated, it's an old case that's reinfected. Do you see where I'm going with this? It's very difficult. So what I have to do is I have to have a very good relationship with the state laboratory so I can call them and say, Anna's in here again and she's reactive. Where is she? Is it up fourfold? Is it down fourfold? Where is she? Not many clinicians in the private practice scenario know to call the health department. So they don't know new cases versus old. And I can tell you, in HIV clinics, you say, where people have positive tests, you say, well, Anne, have you been positive? Oh, yeah, I was treated like 3 years ago. Let it go. And nobody calls up. Nobody calls up and says, Anne's titer is now 1 to 32. What was it last week or last year? Okay, non-reactive, reactive. These are the things, again, no syphilis, what are we doing? How do we interpret this? Okay, so, conventional wisdom, screen with a non-treponemal test because it's inexpensive and it has high sensitivity, but we got problems with specificity, then confirm with the treponemal test. Relatively expensive test, which is highly specific, but has some, you know, sensitivity issues. Okay, that's what we've been doing. But there's changing times. Prevalence of syphilis is extremely low in many industrialized countries. Okay, the labor costs have increased, and we now have treponemal tests, which can be fully automated. How many of you are using these fully automated screening tests? Okay, yeah, just a couple. All right, this is maybe sometimes in the clinician's world one of our biggest problems. So you all screen with the treponemal test, the TPPA or the EIA automated, okay, confirm with the non-treponemal test. And it's important that all specimens that test positive with the initial treponemal test be retested with that RPR. Well, I need a titer. I need something that guide me, right? All right, fine. This is an ELISA test. This is what it looks like. We have the DiSorin, liaison treponemal chemiluminescence assay. And this, you know, for me, it's like when I look at this, okay, you know, I add the sera, you know, put it in the machine, and bing, a magic, you know, thing happens. That's how, as a clinician, I think about it. You guys know this step by step, as we were discussing. There's different systems that are out there. So the new approaches are all patients have a screening ELISA, and if the ELISA is positive or indeterminate, then do an RPR and an FTA sometimes. We'll talk about it, are performed. In some clinical situations, an RPR or an FTA is also ordered. So patient with a genital ulcer or where you're following the RPRs. Now, what should we do with discordant treponemal, non-treponemal test results? That's our problem, the clinician. So I have a positive ELISA and I have a positive RPR. That's fine. I have a positive ELISA and a negative RPR. Now I got a problem. For the first time, we will detect treponemal antibody positive, non-treponemal antibody negative specimens. Where is that person? Is that person in the beginning of the infection, or is that person late in the infection? Do I have to treat this person, or, you know, where am I? The situation has resulted in considerable confusion. both for you and for me. So what we're trying to do, and this is what Dr. Ballard talked about in the webcast. This is an algorithm that's out there. Treponemal test, okay, negative, done. Okay, positive RPR, okay, positive, you got it. And it's up to us to figure out, you know, what's going on with that person, okay? If it's negative, okay, is it probably all treated syphilis? Treatment may be indicated if not previously treated. You know, false positive screening treponemal test suspected. Or if it's not previously treated, retest with a different treponemal test. If the second test is positive, then treat unless there's a history of treatment. And if the second treponemal test is negative, a third treponemal test could be used to resolve the discrepancy between the two treponemal tests. You know, where is this easy? So, I mean, the CDC will actually grapple with this. Syphilis serology, the conventional wisdom should prevail in high prevalence settings, MSM settings, or, you know, the Baltimore City Health Department, but also, where I'm from, but also, I mean, this is something that doctors, private physicians need to think about according to their patient population. So, it's more important to differentiate between active and previously treated disease. Otherwise, you know, overtreatment rates could be unacceptably high. Labor costs largely remain low in comparison to the cost of the test kits, and the capital and maintenance cost of automated systems may be prohibitive in some situations. Okay, so the main point of this conclusion here with syphilis is that the CDC is planning a consultation with APHL again later this year, and I guess Dr. Ballard, if you want to comment on when and how this is all going to work out, you certainly can jump in at the end of this presentation. There's Abbott Determine test. This is not FDA approved in the United States. I throw it out there because it's a treponemal immunochromatographic strip that's been being used and tested in the WHO sites for congenital syphilis, an example of how it looks and then how it's read, positive, negative, and inadequate tests here. But it's nice out in the field, and it's been used for congenital syphilis screening, and actually it's picking up more potential congenital syphilis cases in pregnant women, and it's a good thing. We just don't have it yet FDA approved here. MSM and HSV. Why is it important to diagnose herpes? What's recommended? What are the controversies? There's a lot of herpes out there. This is the estimated prevalence in the United States. 50 million cases. Okay, HSV2, as we talked about, increases the risk of acquiring HIV approximately threefold. No matter how you look at it, mucosal barrier breakage, influx of activated CD4s with herpes and the macrophages, and HIV viral replication actually is increased by HSV2 reactivation and or shedding. And HIV can worsen the clinical and subclinical manifestations of herpes, yes. Okay, this is a model by Anna Wald and Associates trying to figure out the significant portion of HIV in the United States that can be attributed to HSV2. Okay, and MSM, which we're focusing on here, maybe about 35%. This is the model that's over there. In the U.S. population, 19%. The majority of HIV-positive patients are indeed infected with herpes. This is 60 to 70% of HIV-positive patients are infected with herpes type 2, right? So what do we do? Accurately diagnosing genital herpes requires more than just looking at it. And actually, there's a lot of studies out there that say, you know, me as a clinician, if I eyeball this lesion, do I make the right diagnosis? And quite frankly, the answer is no. Here's a clinical diagnosis. Herpes infection via Western blot, clinical diagnosis, 19% incorrectly diagnosed genital herpes, and 61% of patients infected were not diagnosed. So how good are we? Not so good. All right, so the guidelines the CDC has set forth in the last, treatment guidelines is isolation of herpes, I'm good, in cell culture preferred for those who present with lesions or ulcers. All right, but here's the problem. With the culture, there's low sensitivity, especially if I have recurrent lesions. So we want the PCR. A PCR would be brilliant. And actually, we're using that. The state of Maryland is providing us in the clinic PCRs. even though it's not FDA approved, and actually the positivity rate has increased and we're diagnosing much more cases. Lack of virologic herpes detection does not necessarily indicate a lack of herpes infection. In other words, if I don't come in with an ulcer, I still can have herpes. So, you know, we need, and I can shed intermittently. All right. So the guidelines on serologic testing is listed here. Type-specific serologic assays are useful for recurrent or atypical symptoms when somebody has a negative culture. If I come in and I have a clinical diagnosis, I tell you, yeah, I had herpes. It was clinically diagnosed, but I have no confirmation whatsoever. And if I say I have herpes and I don't want to infect Prince Charming, who I'm going to marry, you know, next week, testing him would be important. If he's already infected, then that's not an issue. So you have to consider the serologic testing in comprehensive STD evaluations. Should we do it? Well, you should consider it in people who have multiple sex partners or people that have HIV infection and an MSM at risk for HIV for all the other reasons of the tight association between herpes and acquiring HIV and HIV-infected individuals who have herpes shed herpes virus both symptomatically and asymptomatically more frequently. So we need accurate assays. So here are the CDC right now recognizing recommended tests. They have to be glycoprotein G2 and G1 tests. And they should specifically request these type tests because other old tests are out there which aren't all that good. Now here's the thing. The sensitivity range is anywhere from 80 to 98%. It's not 100%. And this is a little cartoon of what it looks like. We think of the gold standard as being the Western blot, and I'll show you that. But the Western blot's hard, as you all know, is hard to do. It's time-consuming and it's costly. So here's the FDA-approved IgG type-specific tests that are out there. It's the HerpSelect ELISA test for both 1 and 2. The HerpSelect immunoblot for HSV2 and HSV1. There's the BioKit HSV2 rapid test, the CAPSHIA HSV2 HerpSelect test, and then there's other things that are out there that are really not all that good. IgM is not out there. It's not useful for diagnosing herpes type 2, although if I can pick it out of my, you know, wish list of tests when I open up the book. But, it, you know, I don't know what it's telling me, because it's not really, all the preliminary studies, there's no good IgM test, period. Okay, end of story. All right, Western blot profiles, looks really nice, hard to do, expensive, focus, HerpSelect ELISA test, illustrated here. But we, I'm going to come back to this. We have a problem. If you're using this in the United States, that's one type of herpes. If you're using it overseas, this test is not as sensitive. It will not pick up the different HSV2 type. And I'm not, this was presented by Oliver Landecker at ISSTDR. So there's a Kalon test, which is actually is better, but it's not FDA approved, and it's kind of a garage manufacturer. How am I doing on time here, my dear? 4 minutes. The PocKit herpes serologic test sounds great, but it's not as sensitive as we were led to believe in early studies when you take it out into the lab or out into the field. So who should I test? What test should I use as a clinician? Well, we're told to use culture or PCR when the person presents with an ulcer, and that makes sense. Use type-specific serologic tests to confirm a clinical diagnosis. I had it. I was clinically told I had it. I have no ulcers to test now. Okay, let's confirm this. False negative cultures are common, especially in patients who have recurrent infection or healing lesions, because we just don't get enough of the herpes virus on the swab for culture. Diagnose patients with unrecognized infections when the patient has no visible lesions, but describes what's suggestive of a history or having these recurrent genital symptoms. We can rely on these tests. And to accommodate a patient, I want the herpes test. Okay. Others to consider for serologic testing is, and it's in the treatment guidelines, is, you know, okay, I want the test. So, here's another problem, though. The majority of persons infected with herpes have not been diagnosed. Okay? They may have mild or unrecognized infections. They may not have the classic lesions at all. And the majority of genital herpes infections are transmitted by people that don't know they have the infection. Okay, so you're having sex, you're asymptomatic, you're shedding herpes, of course you're going to pass it on that way. In MSM and HIV-infected individuals, this is elevated rates of herpes shedding persist in HIV patients, whether they're treated with HART or not. So yes, co-infected patients do shed, whether they're on HART or not, and they have more days of shedding. So where am I going with this? Should we be screening HIV-infected individuals for herpes? Well, maybe, but I'm not sure. Therapy with oral antiviral agents decrease clinical signs and symptoms. Yes. Some specialists suggest that we do HSV type-specific serology. We should do it on all HIV-positive individuals during their very first examination. So, you know, when I come in and I'm HIV-positive, I should also have a herpes serologic test to see if I have herpes or not. Because suppressive antiviral therapy may decrease my shedding, whether I'm on, you know, to my partner and infecting them. Okay, all right. Perhaps this is a JID article last year. This is one of the most compelling reasons maybe to offer this. Herpes simplex virus suppression with valacyclovir reduces rectal and blood plasma HIV levels in HIV-1 and HSV-2 seropositive men. Now, to me, clinically, this would be the most important reason to screen, to find, to suppress. But if you look at the CDC treatment guidelines on who to recommend this to, it's not quite there yet. So as a clinician, I will say that we have tests that are available for the diagnosis of syphilis in MSM or in anyone. We use them, but they're fraught with problems. With herpes, we have diagnostic serology and tests. I want the PCR. I want it as a point of care test. And I want it now. Okay, so work on that, will you guys? And we have serologic tests. Now, I want to show you that sensitivity range and specificity range are not perfect. So there's one thing to use it in MSM or in the STD clinic, but when you take it out, okay, example, to Johns Hopkins University undergraduates, you think, oh, Baltimore, you can use it. Baltimore has all STDs, you can use it. When we took it to the undergraduates, we had false positive results. So what's going to drive your selection of these tests will be your population and how much you think they're infected. And the positive and negative predictive value will have a definite impact on who you're going to use this for. So we're not perfect yet. Maybe we shouldn't be screening every single human being, MSM or not. I mean, you might find some MSMs that, you know, they have one sexual partner and that's it. So we need to pay more attention to this, and I am finished.
Thank you.
Thank you.